This is Marketplace Money for the weekend of November 27th, 2009. Gobble, gobble. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Marketplace Money is supported by Putnam Investments, supporting financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide since 1937. Putnam, a world of investing.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is Marketplace Money. Welcome to the silly season of personal finance, where early bird sales and weepy TV ads about gift giving act as magnets for the contents of your wallet. Sure, we've heard plenty over the last year about how we are collectively putting the brakes on our shopping carts. But when it comes to the act of buying things, Lee Eisenberg says it is not as simple as need versus want. In fact, he argues, to shop is to be a modern human, and it even gives our lives meaning. He calls it shoptimism, and that's the title of his new book. Thanks for coming in, Lee.
Good to be here.
I have to ask when you started writing this book, because there's not much shoptimism going on these days.
Well, there's more going on these days than there were a few months ago.
True.
I actually started when times were good, and then I had either the fortune or the misfortune to be able to continue researching and reporting, you know, during the great meltdown. On balance, I was actually happy to be able to, you know, chart this strange couple of years, because I do think both what I call the sell side, which is the retail side, and the buy side have each gone through an enormous change, and it will be with us for quite a while.
Well, let's talk about some of that change. The subtitle of your book is Why the American Consumer Will Keep On Buying No Matter What. And as you mentioned, we're already starting to see a little bit of that. So how much change do you think we've really gone through?
Implicit in your question, I think, is this premise or assumption that we were all, or most of us were, you know, raging shopaholics in the first place. And I think that's a misperception. I mean, clearly, a great many millions of people had, you know, eyes bigger than their wallets. But I think that's not exactly an accurate perception of what a great many other people are like. Mm-hmm. You know, if you go back, and what I try to do in the book is not just look at the moment, but I do go back pretty far into the American consumer's past, starting a little bit in the early 19th century, when we really, for the first time, was introduced to a world of abundance. You know, these incredibly beautiful department stores in the big cities, and a great new working class, but at least an employed working class, were able to go into these places and start spending money on a pretty regular basis. Flash forward a little bit, we had the Depression, which was convulsive. It very much changed our mindset. And then, you know, flash forward another couple decades, and we were in the 50s, which was, you know, the golden age of prosperity, and took us pretty much up to 2007. And I think throughout all of that period, even though we were spending an awful lot of money, we can't forget that there's something about the American character that is rooted in frugalism. And I'm not suggesting that, you know, we're going to become frugal. And I'm not suggesting we're not going to make impulsive, reckless buys, but I think it's a mistake to paint with too broad a brush that, you know, we were all these mindless sheep being led to our slaughter by, you know, manipulative marketers. I think a great many of us deserve more credit, though not necessarily a greater credit limit.
Oh, nice line.
You like that?
You know, there are a lot of consumer activists who you refer to as buy scolds. I like that. It's B-U-Y, by the way, for the radio audience. Frankly, it seems like over the last year, we became a nation of these.
Well, when I refer somewhat jocularly to buy scolds, I'm really talking about very, very serious anti-consumerists who, you know, who write manifestos and who, as you say, urge us to live off the land, you know, to make our own clothes and so on and so forth. That's a pretty extreme version of what you're talking about. You know, the thing that I object to in terms of those sort of extreme buy scolds is they don't give us much credit for personal judgment. And at the same time, they blame marketing and advertising, you know, as if we don't play a role in that, you know, and they sort of leave us unscathed in their criticism.
You spend quite a bit of the book talking about and looking at the idea of need versus want. Can you briefly tell us what you found?
It's not a simple distinction. You know, obviously, there are a handful of needs that no one would argue with. Shelter, food, water. We need clothing. But the minute you expand the definition ever so slightly and get into what are emotional needs, then suddenly I could easily fill in a lot of material things that satisfy those needs. In the book, I talk about a man who spends a fortune on model trains. By no definition, no narrow definition, is a model train set a need. But this man, who's a friend of mine, derives enormous satisfaction and gains a lot of respect from others when he both assembles and then shares his model train set. How many of us have our dad's old watch, you know, in the top drawer of our dressers, or we hold on to a shirt, or, you know, we walk into a room and we smell Old Spice, and that was, you know, the smell of an uncle or something like that. So the things we own can be argued to be extensions of who we are. And that, I think, is a very interesting and provocative idea, and it never comes up in sort of the cartoon debate of whether, you know, we're all way out of control shopaholics or whether we're not.
The book is called Shoptimism, Why the American Consumer Will Keep on Buying No Matter What. And we've been talking with the author, Lee Eisenberg. Lee, always nice to talk with you. And thanks so much for coming in.
Tess, thank you.
If you're feeling shoptimistic and braving the crowds this weekend, you no doubt noticed that retailers are going all out to get your attention. But despite the banners, the fireworks, yes, fireworks, and discounts, there are some people who are just impossible to shop for, like men. But leave it to those retailers to invent the perfect gift for the man in your life. From the Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk, Caitlin Carroll has this illuminating story.
Candles don't sound like something a tough guy would want. But what about mandals?
Don't know what to get the man who is admired for his manliness by other manly men? Never fear. The Chuck Norris Sweat Mandel is here.
I have no idea where that came from.
It came from YouTube. It's a spoof on mandals. Jennifer Catron and her husband Mark started the candle company a few months ago. It's not their first venture.
Been through so many.
Yeah, I'll spend a lot of hours looking around to see what's hot and what's not, and but to be honest, mainly to be looking for what's not there.
What's not there? Candles designed for men, with special manly smells like dirt and rawhide. To see if this is something a guy would actually buy, I head out to Big Wang's Sports Bar in Hollywood. I find Brad Caracciolo drinking beer and watching football.
I buy candles for my room.
What kind?
What did I get last time? Mango.
It seems promising. So I take out the mandal and light it up. It's bacon scented.
This smells like the sponge in a urinal.
There are others, like Bass Killer, Auto Shop, Meat and Potatoes. Caracciolo shakes his head.
I buy my candles so it smells good for girls, not for me.
His buddy, Gerard Palacios, says this is definitely something a guy would not buy for himself.
It's the type of product a girlfriend would buy for you and then you'd break up the next week, but you'd have a mandal at the end of the relationship. So it was a win-win-win, you know?
And there's the rub. The candles are for men, but about 90% of all candles, almost $2 billion worth, are bought by women. So how do you sell a $15 candle that smells, well, kind of gross? Play up the novelty factor. Joe Priester is a marketing professor at the University of Southern California.
I think it can get people who sort of buy it because it's sort of ironic and hip, and I think still tap into people that are really buying it from a more non-ironic position.
That can work, says Joseph Pedot, godfather of the novelty business. He's behind
Chia. Chia Pets
and
Clap On, Clap Off.
The Clapper. Pedot says to make a mark in the novelty business, products have to be fun, cheap to sell, but even cheaper to make.
And that's like finding a needle in a haystack. It really is. If you get one, then it's worth it.
The Catrons think they may have one. They've made a couple $1,000s on mandals in the first few months of business, and they're expanding the line.
A couple of upcoming smells we're going to have is burnt gunpowder, which is like in pretty high demand. We've received lots of requests.
I'd then, like to do wet dog, but I haven't figured out how exactly you put wet dog into a machine.
What they really need is to figure out how to turn stink into the sweet smell of profits. In Los Angeles, I'm Caitlin Carroll for Marketplace Money.
And this is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. While the smell of burning bacon may seem like a good idea for that special man in your life, I doubt that most people will be slapping down the plastic to pay for it. Because besides the ooh factor, seems we may be getting a bit better at handling our credit. This week, TransUnion reported that credit card delinquencies fell in the third quarter. Of course, from the desk of lies, damn lies, and statistics, on that very same day, Moody's reported that delinquencies rose in October. Managing credit is and always will be a daily battle, especially if you're unemployed. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith has that story.
Not only are more people unemployed, more people are staying unemployed. The number of people running out of unemployment benefits is at its highest level in decades, and that's going to deal another blow to the economy, mounting credit card defaults. David Robertson is the publisher of the Nilson Report, an industry newsletter.
When that paycheck goes away, decisions have to be made. Mortgages, car loans, etc., and the credit card bill is mostly the one that goes by first.
Credit card defaults have hit record highs. This year, the industry is expected to lose around $80 billion. Still, economist Greg McBride says credit card debt will not be the new mortgage debt.
The numbers are much, much smaller. The implication of defaults on the broader economy, isn't something that really even belongs in the same conversation as what we've seen in the mortgage side.
We owe about $1 trillion on our cards. Compare that to the roughly $11 trillion we owe on our mortgages. But those numbers don't tell the whole story, says Robert Manning, founder of the Responsible Debt Relief Program. He says these days people are using their cards for rent and food. So when they start missing card payments, it's a sign they're slipping over the edge.
While the outstanding amount of credit card debt sounds very small compared to mortgage debt, it's going to expose all these other trillions of dollars in consumer debt that people may have to default on.
Manning expects a flood of personal bankruptcies this year, and he says that could have devastating effects throughout the economy. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace Money.
People who lose their homes to foreclosure don't always leave quietly. They might strip the molding, take the kitchen sink, or spray paint a message on the wall.
I want the new owners to know, look, this is my home. Take care of it.
Meet a couple in Las Vegas who let everyone know how they felt about losing their house. It's coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. For all the small signs pointing up in this economy, two huge pieces continue to point down. The first, of course, is jobs. We'll get to that a bit later in the show. The second is the housing market. We learned this week from the real estate firm First American CoreLogic that more than 10 million homes have negative equity. That means the owners owe more than the house is currently worth. They are underwater. And that means there's a good chance some of them will default and end up in foreclosure. We wanted to get a sense of what that's like to go through a foreclosure. So Chrissy Clark of American Radio Works headed to Las Vegas to profile one couple and the house they lost.
You've probably never been to Broxburn Street in Las Vegas, but you've seen places like it. When I first visited 6 months ago, Broxburn was just another half-empty street in what was becoming a suburban ghost town. A ghost burb, I guess you'd call it. Empty stucco houses, brown lawns, a row of signs that said, for sale, bank owned, and...
Smell it.
Terrible stink.
It's just a very distinctive, like, algae, you know?
Algae, rotting leaves, a drowned bird. The smell was coming from three filthy swimming pools in the backyards of three foreclosed homes right next to each other. I was with a guy named Rob Cole. His job is to clean pools that have been abandoned.
More things living in that pool than the house. A lot more.
But there are traces of the people who used to live here. A birdhouse nailed to a tree, the ruins of a rock-lined fish pond. And looking through a window into the living room of 3613 Broxburn.
Wow, look at what it says there.
Wow, that's really sad.
There's a message spray-painted in neat black letters on one of the walls.
After 15 years here, thanks.
So what happened to the family who spray-painted this message once they moved out? And what happened to the house they left behind?
Hi!
Hi, how are you?
I found the answer to the first question a few miles away from suburban Broxburn Street, but also a world away, at the Oasis RV Park in Lot 652. A woman with bleach blonde hair is sitting in a lawn chair, holding a Coca-Cola glass full of pink wine.
I'm a little nervous. I've had 2 glasses of point cake, but I have iced tea for you.
That's Kimberly Teal. She and her husband, Mike, are both in their 50s. They used to own the house at 3613 Broxburn. Kim spray-painted the message on the wall right before they left. She gets emotional just talking about it.
I want the new owners to know, look, this is my home. Take care of it.
Now Kim and Mike have a new home, a 25-foot motor home.
This is where we live.
Now, this used to be our party rig, okay?
The tour of the party rig doesn't take long. It's just one room, plus a toilet in the closet and a nook in the back for the bed.
I gutted it all out, put all new wallpaper in, and
it's home.
They've barely finished showing me their new home before they turn to memories of their old one, the only one they ever owned, where they lived with their 2 daughters and their aging parents.
Happy Thanksgiving!
Happy Thanksgiving.
Mike puts on this home movie from Thanksgiving a few years ago.
And this is our turkey this year.
Looks kind of good.
And you like
Kim can't take her eyes off the screen where her smiling relatives flicker by.
You've got a beautiful home here.
I used to have a nice house, huh? Look at it.
Where are you going? Yeah, we did it all ourselves, just her and I. Redid all the cupboards, put all new appliances in. Redid the floor. Everything in there is all brand new for somebody else.
The Teals lost their home in a way that's become painfully familiar. They refinanced for the second time at the peak of the real estate boom to an adjustable rate mortgage, but they didn't read the fine print about how much the interest rate would rise after a few years. Once it did rise,
I actually read the fine paperwork and we got screwed.
They couldn't afford it. Kim was at home full-time taking care of their sick parents. One had Alzheimer's, another cancer. And as hard as they tried to stretch Mike's income as a slot machine repairman, it just wasn't enough to cover the mortgage. Finally, last November, the bank gave them 3 days to get out. So Mike and Kim moved into their motorhome. Not long before, both their elderly parents had passed away, and their older daughter had already moved out of the house. But their younger daughter had just graduated from high school and was still living at home. Now, she's couch surfing with friends.
You know what that does to my heart? I've worked my whole freaking life to make sure my kids had everything. And now the whole family is all...
They're all over the place.
They're everywhere because they haven't got a centering point.
It's really hard to see, I'm sure, to see your parents go from a house into your motorhome and in a park.
You know how they treated you at work? Tell her that. Trailer trash.
Oh, yeah, they call me trailer trash. I'm sure they don't mean any harm in it. They're, you know, it's just a joke to them, but it's not a joke to me.
And it's hard to forget the home they used to have. The Teals haven't gone back to their home on Broxburn Street, but I have, to see what life after foreclosure has been like for the house.
I'm standing in front of the house. Looks like somebody has moved in.
There were moving boxes stacked on the front porch. 3 dogs barked at me through the door. A woman in her 50s named Carrie Michelle Reeves bought the house in April with cash for $120,000. That's $10,000 less than it cost when the Teals bought it 15 years ago. Reeves didn't want to talk on tape about how she'd benefited from someone else's misfortune, but she did let me come inside and see the house. She's gutted the place, knocked down walls, repainted everything, including the spray-painted message that said, "After 15 years here, thanks." I asked her how she felt about that message that the Teals had left, and she said, "I feel sad for them, but they made bad decisions. Their loss is my gain."
Okay, this is our local bathroom, right? Now, you think I'm a weirdo? Come on in here.
Kim Teal is taking me past rows of motorhomes to the public bathroom at the Oasis RV Park. This has become her refuge.
If you turn this on, steam, and you sit in here and put your music on, okay? Now you're going to do yourself all in salt and olive oil, okay? And you're going to dye your hair because you can't do it in the rig.
When she's not giving herself spa treatments in the public bathroom, Kim is busy looking for a job. It's hard in this economy, but not as urgent. Now that the Teals don't have a mortgage, the income that they do have goes further, and they can spend it on things they couldn't when they owned the house on Broxburn Street.
Fixing her teeth up.
I got a lot of money on my teeth.
So there was things that we let lag behind, like going to the doctor for skin cancer that I have.
But you have to have co-payments, you know, and it's like we didn't have that. We wouldn't even think about that. But it's now that we are taking care of ourselves a little bit better now.
Kim's gotten into photography recently, and she shows me a picture she took on her cell phone from the door of their motorhome.
Oh, look at this.
One of those perfect sunsets with the light streaming through the clouds.
I mean, if you have to go to bed every single night and look at this, can't be that bad, can it?
In Las Vegas, I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace Money.
For more of our coverage of how the downturn is reshaping people's lives, go to marketplace.org and click on The Big Shift. Here's another sad statistic in the housing crisis. Take a look around your neighborhood. Out of every 10 houses, odds are one of them is behind on mortgage payments. The Mortgage Bankers Association says that is the worst showing since it started keeping records in 1972. As homeowners find themselves in trouble and unable to sell for anything resembling an asking price, they're turning to short sales. That's where you work with the bank to sell for less than you owe on the mortgage. But as Peter O'Dowd reports from station KJZZ in Phoenix, convincing the bank to let you off the hook can be a logistical nightmare.
You can knock all day on the front door of this house in Peoria, Arizona, and no one will answer. Chris George and his family haven't lived here since June 2008. That's the year George lost his job and eventually his life savings. When I called George in California, he said one of the few things he actually wants to lose is the house itself.
This was the house that, you know, we moved into after we got married, and this is the house that we had our first son in, and we loved this place, and now it's just turned into this burden that we can't wait to get rid of.
Back in 2005, George bought the house for $209,000 with no down payment. He moved his family near Palm Springs last summer to find work. But before George abandoned this house, he asked the bank for permission to sell it at a loss. He even offered to pay the remainder of the mortgage himself.
The difference would have come in around $5,000 or $10,000. You know, that's pretty easy to do.
The bank didn't like that idea, and the George family's finances spiraled downward. 15 months later, the house is scheduled for auction, and only now has the lender changed its tune. This time it will consider a short sale if the couple pays the difference in the mortgage. Well, now the gap between the loan amount and the sale price is more like $50,000. George says the worst part has been dealing with the excruciating wait. Joe Watson hears that complaint a lot. She's the CEO of a local real estate agency.
If you're thinking this is going to be over in 20 or 30 days, then you're setting yourself up for failure or a lot of frustration.
It appears that frustration is mounting. In Phoenix, where housing prices have fallen drastically, realtors say nearly half of all homes under contract are pending short sales. Some of those sales will take more than 9 months to close. Watson says many agents are overwhelmed and undertrained.
Agents don't like to hear that, you know, they're part of the problem, but we are.
That's because a short sale transaction is complicated. Before a lender swallows a loss, it wants to be sure the homeowner isn't just trying to wiggle out of a devalued property. So a seller needs to show hardship with stacks of tax records and financial statements. If agents do a poor job collecting this information, the wait gets longer. Watson says banks are to blame too. Bank A has one set of rules, Bank B has another, and Watson says those bank policies can change with little warning.
We've had short sales where we've submitted offers and gotten a no, and then we've pulled them back, resubmitted the offer a week later, and gotten a yes.
We understand the frustration on the consumer's ends. We understand the frustration on the real estate broker's end.
John Meacham is with the Mortgage Bankers Association. He says banks are slammed with short sales, and dealing with the paperwork takes time.
A bank is in the business of trying to minimize losses, whether it's through a short sale or through a foreclosure, so there is a lot of due diligence that needs to be done.
Part of that diligence includes measuring financial hardship, and that can be the trickiest part of a short sale. Technically, sellers just need to show that if they don't sell the house soon, they'll eventually lose it to foreclosure. But the reality is different. Even banks acknowledge that homeowners in default will be the first in line. As a result, some people stop paying their mortgage and destroy their credit in the process. Short sales aren't just a headache for sellers. Josiah Pinner is a first-time buyer who'd been shopping for houses for months. From his car, he points out a two-story stucco house that he put an offer on back in March.
I kind of really did just put all my eggs in one basket there. I just pretty much expected it to go through.
4 months later, the bank came back with an answer that made little sense to him. It would agree to a short sale only if the seller paid an extra $3,000 to the bank. The owner was broke and couldn't do it, but Pinner was willing to take on the cost himself.
If I could roll it into my loan, you know, but that just wasn't an option for them.
The deal was dead, and Pinner feared if he had to wait for another short sale to go through, he would miss out on President Obama's homebuyer tax credit. So he got back into his car and drove a mile down the street where he found a nearly identical house already in foreclosure. With no need for a short sale, that deal was sealed in a week. In Phoenix, I'm Peter Rodowd for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. It's time to take some of your questions, and here to do that with me this week is Marketplace Economics Editor Chris Farrell. Hi, Chris.
Hello, Tess.
You ready for some questions?
Oh, absolutely.
Well, Chris, Leanne writes in from Moortown, Vermont, and she's got a 401k, and her employer matches 3% of it. Not bad.
Okay.
But she has noticed that in her statements, sometimes her employer has not deposited what's been taken out of her check, or they haven't deposited the match for the quarter. So she's wondering where these contributions are going, what is going on, and is this legal for her employer to be holding on to that money for a significant time period before they deposit it?
It's not a simple answer. My guess is that her employer is doing everything by the book. I mean, there are a lot of rules and regulations, and there are penalties. Mm-hmm. And most employers don't mess around with the retirement savings plan because, by the way, management is also participating in that retirement savings plan. But the rules are kind of squishy, and a third of the complaints about 401k plans have to do with exactly what she's talking about.
Hmm.
So here's what the rule is. The regulation is that the employer is supposed to get the money deposited as quickly as possible.
As quickly as possible? That's what it
says? As quickly as possible. But technically, if you were paid in May, so say you're paid May 15th mm-hmm. or May 10th, whenever you're paid, the contribution has to go into the account by the 15th business day of June.
So they have a full month.
So they essentially have a full month. Now, if they are routinely doing that, the Department of Labor is going to get upset at them because what the Department of Labor has done is said, this is not a safe harbor. You can't be doing this on a routine basis. But there is some leeway there because the money comes out of the account. It gets segregated. Depending if it's a multinational corporation, it may be coming in from all over the world or at least all over the United States. So there is some leeway there.
But Chris, where is it going? Where is it sitting? Is it just sitting in the company coffers?
What it's sitting in is in a short-term investment fund called a STIF. And you're not necessarily being stiffed by the money being put in a STIF.
Okay.
The employer owns that account. It makes a little bit of interest, hardly anything, but it does make some interest. And that interest, by the way, does go to the employer, does not go to the employee.
Hmm.
But it is in a segregated account, and that's really the key.
All right. So for Leanne, I guess then she would want to track how long her employer is holding on to this money. And if it's a couple weeks, 3 weeks or longer, then where does she turn?
First thing you do is you turn to, if you have a CFO, human resources department, depending on what the size of the company is. And I would just say, what's going on? You know, what's happening here? This is our money. I don't understand. Then I would go to the website of the Department of Labor, and there is a whole process, and then you can make a formal complaint to the Department of Labor. But the first thing that I would do is just go to human resources. If it's a very small company, it might be chief financial officer, something like that, and say, explain to me what's going on, because this is our money. The rules give you a little bit of flexibility, but what the rules are designed, you're not supposed to be using it for your own purposes for a considerable period of time.
All right, let's go to the phones again. And Carolyn is calling from Tallahassee, Florida. Hi, Carolyn.
Hey, how are you doing?
Doing well. What can we do for you today?
My question is, I make about 60 grand a year, say, and I put about 20% of it to my company's 401k, and they match that at 5%. And I was wondering, you know, I'm 26, I'm not going to be retiring anytime soon, but should it be all going toward 401k, or is there something else I should be putting it towards?
Oh, I know what Chris is going to say. It begins with an R.
The Roth IRA.
The Roth IRA. That's right.
The Roth IRA. The advantage of putting some money into the Roth IRA, now it's after tax money that you put into the Roth. So you're not going to get the tax deduction that you get with the 401k. But your money compounds, compounds, compounds. And then when you retire many, many, many years from now, you withdraw all the gain tax-free. But here's the real trick with the Roth. Let's say you put the maximum in. Let's say you put $5,000 in. And then it turns out, I need $2,000 just because there's some sort of emergency come along, really need $2,000. You can withdraw the $2,000 contribution with no penalty, no tax consequence, because you've already paid taxes on it. So in a way, a Roth is an incredible vehicle. And this is why Tess says she knows what I'm going to say. It's both a wonderful retirement savings plan and a safe stash for emergency savings.
Okay. All right. Great. Thank you so much.
Thanks for the call, Carolyn.
All right,
bye. Bye-bye. We can answer your questions anytime. Call and leave us a voicemail at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or you can write us an email. You'll find the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. We'll be back with more Getting Personal later in the show. It makes sense that a video resume would pop more than a traditional paper one. But sit down to watch, and you'll see many job candidates who aren't ready for prime time.
I've spent the past 2 years on the road traveling, and I also have been involved in nonprofit work.
Yeah, you see? Already I'm bored.
Cash Peters goes lurking next on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. We mentioned earlier that jobs are one of the economic engines that's still stuck in reverse. The official unemployment rate is now more than 10%. And that doesn't even count folks who are working fewer hours or those who've taken big pay cuts. The picture also isn't complete without a look at those who are left behind after layoffs. Yes, they are lucky to still be working, but a new reality does start to seep into the daily grind, and that is affecting employee behavior. Jim Davis is with the talent management firm DDI, and his company conducted a survey of about 1,000 still employed non-management workers, and I asked him what they found.
We were somewhat surprised to hear that over half of these workers feel that their careers are stagnant or in limbo.
And did they tell you why?
Yes, they did. How I would term this is they said that they were in the know. They had no challenging assignments. They have no opportunities to learn new skills. They have no room to advance. They get no recognition. And they have no line of sight to how their jobs fit in with the objectives of the organization.
Then how do those feelings of stagnation manifest themselves in the workplace? What's happening?
People are going to actively seek new jobs as the economy improves. People are saying things like, I just do what's asked of me, nothing more, nothing less. I just do my job and go home. Hmm. As opposed to people that say, I'm interested in what I do. I'm excited about going to work. And it has a negative impact on productivity and quality and customer service in organizations.
Frankly, that just sounds like a bad tude.
It may be a bad tune. We did ask people, what they're doing about it, and individuals are not going and talking to their boss about their future. 42% of the people that DDI surveyed have not had those kind of conversations, and we think that that would be important for people to be able to make some changes and to do some things differently.
Did they say why they're not talking to the boss about their unhappiness?
No, they didn't say why they're not talking to the boss, but they did tell us some of the other things that they were doing. We found that people were more likely to do things like watch YouTube videos or check their Facebook site than to help a fellow employee with work or to take on extra assignments. And we also found that one out of every five people are calling in playing hooky at work when they could be at work.
Oh my goodness. That is really counterintuitive to me, given the job situation in this country. I mean, yeah, you can be unhappy at work, but isn't this kind of the worst time to display that?
I agree with that. And like I say, we were sort of surprised to see that figure come up, that it does seem like it would be a time to be at work every day, to
right.
be working hard, to be doing all that you can do. I think that people, because they feel that their workloads have increased so much, 53% of the people in the DDI study felt that their workload has increased 25% or more. And I think we get a little bit of, well, I'm entitled to a day off here or there, which is a terrible attitude to have.
Then how can companies motivate their workers now? You know, there are not a lot of raises coming. Bonuses have gone the way of the dodo bird, unless you're the CEO. You know, promotions probably not likely in this economic situation. How do you motivate a worker?
I think we go back to some of those areas that we would call the land of the no and turn those into the land of the yes. Hmm. So we look to give workers challenging assignments. We look to take these times to develop new skills in people. And we look to provide recognition. We're probably not going to be able to provide room to advance right now, but we can do recognition, build skills, and create challenging assignments.
Jim Davis is with the talent management firm DDI, and we've been talking about their survey of the current American workforce. Thanks for coming in.
Hey, thank you for having me, Tess.
Now, I know some of you will not agree with my assessment that if you still have a job in this economy, you might want to put complaints about your workload on hold. But here's another option. Find a way to work for yourself. Commentator Charles Handy says we need to start thinking about jobs in a whole new light.
Let's be realistic. Jobs are going to be in short supply for the next few years. Of course, it does depend on what you mean by a job. The other day, I was having lunch with an advertising executive. He was bemoaning the fact that he had lost his job while still at the height of his powers, as he saw it. Just at that moment, the electrician who was working in his house put his head around the door. "I won't be back for a couple of days," he said. "I've got another job to fit in." In his world, a job meant a client. In my friend's world, it meant an employer. There's no obvious limit to the number of electrician-type jobs that can exist, or plumbers, or accountants. The world is full of potential clients for something. The problem is that you have to create the something yourself, and most of us are not born entrepreneurs, particularly if we've grown up and even grown old in institutions, moving from school to college to organization, places where work is shoved at you, yours only to pick up your shovel or pen and deal with it. It's best to practice it young, if you can. I said to my kids, when you leave college, don't get a job at first. Find someone who will pay you money for something you make or do for them. It'll be good practice for life later on. But it's never too late to start, and more of us will have to one day, now that life is longer and organizations much slimmer. I did it. I became fed up with organizations, grew out of them really, and went on my own when I was 49. Cold calling potential clients, learning to live a cash flow life after a salaried one, it was hard at first. But I learnt to love the freedom and the joy of working with people rather than for people. Besides, if you are your own boss, it's up to you how hard you work, or where, or when, or why.
Management consultant Charles Handy is a founder of the London Business School. His most recent book is called Myself and Other More Important Matters. We are back with more Getting Personal, and I'm here with Chris Farrell, our economics editor. And Chris, we've got more people with more questions. Kevin is on the line from Cincinnati, Ohio. Hi, Kevin.
Hi.
So what's your question for us today?
My question is, how do you manage long-term retirement savings and debt repayment, like student loans and other kind of debt that comes up in a young person's life? I'm in my mid-20s right now, so kind of looking towards that bigger picture, but then still managing some of the annual problems that come with college debt, you know?
Right. Oh, boy, yeah. Do we know about those. Well, this is a very broad question. Why don't you tell us a little bit about some of the specifics of your situation?
Okay. Well, I went to an out-of-state tuition kind of situation, so I've got over $50,000 in student loans, and so I'm current on everything, all kinds of, all my debt monthly, but I just kind of want to get this picture, and And so as far as the details go, as long as I maintain employment, I think I can kind of take care of it.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm trying to balance the IRA. When do I open this? When do I do that?
Well, Chris,
yeah.
When we look at Kevin's situation, as he said, he is young. So the question here is, and I think it's a common one, you know, how do you decide how much of your income should be going toward your future planning, retirement, buying a house,
yeah.
and how much should be going toward debt repayment?
One other question for Kevin, do we have any credit card debt?
Yes, some, but I plan on taking care of that in the next few months.
Okay. You want to get rid of the credit card debt, which you're going to do. So that's upfront. Everybody listening to this, you just get rid of the credit card debt. And then the other thing is to make sure that you're participating in a retirement savings plan. You want to harness the power of time. When you open up that account when you're young, it just means the money's going to compound longer. I'm agnostic to some extent, whether it's a 401k or a Roth. To a large extent, that will be dictated by whether or not your employer offers some sort of retirement savings plan at work.
So at some point, I'll get to the point where I can pay off all of my student loans in one lump kind of, you know, payment. So I'm looking at it maybe about being 30 years old and being able to just pay off all of the student debt and be completely debt-free other than maybe a mortgage if I do decide to purchase a home in the next few years. Would you recommend that, getting rid of all of the debt, or taking that money and plowing it into this retirement fund over the next, you know, 8 years and maybe pushing out that student loan repayment into my 30s.
Two observations I have from this. One of the things, and I don't know, Tess, if you've noticed this, where people get into trouble, student loans is an investment. It is a big chunk of debt. And then they look at a home, which is another good investment, but it also requires a lot of debt. What I would be wary about is taking on too much debt between the student loans and home ownership. But at this point in time, since the home ownership is farther down the road and is down the future, I would actually be saving. And then if it turns out you have a chunk of money, then you are in a really strong position. You can say, all right, you know, my financial position is good enough. I can have the student loan and I can have the home ownership. Or, you know what, 30 years old and debt-free, that's not bad. But you have the choice. The power comes from having the choice and making that right decision 5 to 7 years from now.
So what do you think, Kevin?
Yeah, just kind of a money is power kind of thing at this point, I guess. Freedom.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks for the call.
Thank you for your time.
Bye-bye. And we got an email from Evelyn who wants to know the best approach to saving money for her son's college education. He is her eldest, first going off to college, Chris.
Okay.
You're familiar with that, right?
Oh, absolutely. I have a senior in high school, and I just want to say they go off to college way too fast.
Oh, I'm sure they do. But he is actually still only in junior high. The family has money in a mutual fund, but when the downturn hit last fall, they stopped adding to it. And since then, they've been putting some money aside every month into a CD that is at 3.75%, which actually isn't too bad. Now, the mutual fund has recovered some ground since its low point. Evelyn wants to know when to start moving money out of the mutual fund and into something a little more stable, like the CD that they have.
Well, I know it's going to come as a big shock to you, Tess. But my advice is going to be conservative.
Really?
It really is. Because think of the past couple years we've been through. And so many of our listeners and emailers, you know, they were really traumatized with their 529 plans that were heavily in the stocks during the bear market. So I would be opportunistic as the market rallies. I would be taking money off the table, putting it into the CDs, because you know what? You're going to end up writing those checks a lot quicker than you think.
The tuition, room, board, it just keeps adding up and adding up.
It keeps adding up. So what this strategy is saying, you're going to provide yourself a floor so that he has choice, so he has options. You're not going to try and reach and stretch to make the most money that you possibly could, because the risk is simply too great.
At an earlier age, would you recommend that they go a little less safe?
Absolutely. I like the idea of age-based investing when it comes to saving for college. And what that means is when your child is born, if you have the money, or 2 years old, you know, you're heavily into equities.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here's my beef. Age-based funds became risky over the past several years, as we all embraced the cult of equities.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how people got surprised. They went into age-based thinking this is conservative. But the rules got changed and they were heavily into stocks, even when the child was a senior in high school. But the closer you get to college, the more you want that money to be in cash.
All right. So there you go, Evelyn. Thanks for writing in. Unfortunately, those are all the questions we can take on this week's show, but Chris is now answering your personal finance questions online every weekday. Just visit our website, it's marketplace.org, and click on the Getting Personal link. You can also call us at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Chris, thanks as always for the great advice.
Thanks a lot, Tess.
Marketplace Money is supported by FINRA Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant-making and educational funding. Online at finrafoundation.org.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Earlier, we heard about one option for those Americans who find themselves without a job: create one. While that may get the creative juices flowing, it probably still makes sense to keep looking for work the old-fashioned way. Scan the job sites, network with your friends and former coworkers, and update the resume. There are lots of new ways to do that, you know. Cash Peters explains.
Hey, are you out of work? Tired of getting no response to your boring old resume? Then pay attention, because recruiting expert Mark Sadovnik has decided to help you.
Companies are being swarmed with resumes. So you got to do something different.
You do. And you know what that something different is? According to him, anyway. ResBuzz.
ResBuzz.com is helping individuals, companies, and recruiters differentiate themselves with the power of video networking.
Yes. That's their promo video. Basically, ResBuzz is a website that allows
individuals to set themselves apart and effectively highlight their strongest attributes.
Exactly. By shooting a video resume with their webcam and posting it online. Or, if your strongest attribute is that you're plain lazy, then for around $500, ResBuzz will make the video for you.
Complete with professional sound and lighting.
Ooh, sound. Actually, the video resume is useful for potential employers, too. It gives them the chance to pre-screen you and meet you ahead of time, without all the awkwardness that comes with not actually liking you when they do. Casey Eberhardt is a public speaker and one of their clients. He'll try anything to be successful.
My shtick is about the energy I bring to a room. If somebody sees me on a video, there's a higher likelihood that they're going to get what my personality is about.
Whatever happened to sleeping your way to the top?
Oh, I do that as well. That's why I'm at the top.
One downside of this service, if you ignore the obvious fact that some people are so shy and awkward on camera that they might actually wreck their chances of ever finding work, is that whereas before you might have been able to lie or exaggerate on your paper resume and kind of get away with it, with video, it's slightly trickier.
It is harder to lie on video. If I'm a recruiter, I would almost think that I'm finding out more about who the real person is than what their lies are going to be on the resume.
I've spent the past 2 years on the road traveling and really getting a lot of practical world experience.
This is one of their most recent video resumes.
I've done some travel writing in the past couple years. And I also have been involved in nonprofit work.
Yeah. You see? Already I'm bored. And that's the problem. I'd turn this off after 2 seconds. Catherine Gray is one of the company's directors.
There's something about telling it in your own story, in your own passion, in your own enthusiasm that makes it come alive that the paper resume cannot accomplish.
Yeah, you see, when I'm in the room being interviewed, you're not going to get rid of me until I've made my point. If I'm on video, they can just shut me off.
Well, it gives you a little bit more of an advantage, though, than that piece of paper.
Love is the most important value in my life, to love thy neighbor as thyself.
Oh, God. Hey, you know what would be even better than this? Dispense with the resume altogether, track down the boss you want to work for, and get FaceTime with them directly, in a bar, for instance. Mark Sadovnik likes this idea, while simultaneously thinking it's completely idealistic and stupid.
What's the chances that I'm going to meet Cash at the bar and get him to...
Actually, quite a lot, to be honest with you.
Oh, probably, okay. So what can you do? What can most people do? The 80, 90% of people that won't have the opportunity to meet somebody at the bar. You got to do something different to get noticed.
20 minutes in a sauna.
With whom?
Well, with your future employer.
Well, absolutely. If you can find that they're there, let's face it. The bottom line is relationship. Somehow you got to get in the door.
That's true. And maybe ResBuzz is one way to do that. After all,
it's the new digital recruitment platform for the 21st century.
Well, you know, probably. In Los Angeles,
I appreciate honesty integrity.
Quick, where's the off switch? I'm Cash Peters for Marketplace Money.
And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, if you are negotiating for a raise, here's one thing to remember. Keep your cool.
If they told me no, I think I would cry in the office. And I know that's just, you know, rule number one is you never cry in negotiations, ever.
There's no crying in baseball either. Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Stephen Hoffman and Eve Troh. Our technical director is Josh Rogerson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again. Marketplace Money is supported by Putnam Investments, offering strategies for investors seeking both returns and lower volatility. On the web at putnam.com/absolute return.
American Public Media.